Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Whose phone is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
The second captain's
world service.
It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's the persuasion of the world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Magnificent achievement in the history of Irish soccer. Ireland are there.
So went Ireland, and I had a famous press conference where they wanted to know everyone in the world and had got the job except me. And got on with the job then. I had thoughts on international football, how we should play. Everybody played the same way in the world. I went to the World Cup in Mexico. They were like peas in a pod. They played through a playmaker. They all played a sweeper. They all played possession football. And nobody would commit anybody forward until the playmaker was in possession in a good area, and then they would commit themselves a little bit. And I thought, well, we can't enter this fray with the Irish team and play that way, because it'll take us years to catch up and produce a team with the quality that they had got, the type of game they played. So we introduced a game like we play the ball into the corners, condense the areas, put them under pressure and play from there. And it worked a charm. It wasn't a knockabout, take your time game. It was a rush game, more of the sort of game that the Irish expected of their own Gaelic players. You get the ball forward, you compete, you chase people, you close people down, you create excitement, you win balls when you shouldn't win balls, you commit yourself to the game. A lot of the pundits didn't like it, but the teams that we played against hated it. They'd never experienced anything like we dictated to them. I mean, Ireland actually beat Brazil. Not many people know that, but we did. Okay, it was at Lansdowne Road, it was 1-0. But we beat Brazil, and we've beaten every team of any quality in the world.
Brady again. Yes!
Have I missed football? Yes, I have. I miss the involvement with the players, because I'm not really a manager, I'm a coach. I miss it when I go to a football match, because I've nothing to go to the football match for. Unless I'm supporting the club. I love the North East clubs. I'd like to see them do well. So I'm on their side. But I've nothing to look at and see. I've no player to watch. I've no analysis to do on the game. I've no notes to make. I've no preparation to do for a game that's coming up. I've no young lads to have a look at or try or to talk to or to try and bring through. But then I look at it and I'm 62. The team needed to be restructured and rebuilt. And when you've been there 10 years, that makes it that much harder. I'd done me bit. It was time for me to leave. And I suppose now, after 10 years, I'm as much Irish as I am English. I am now an Irish citizen, not an honorary. I'm an Irish citizen. I've got my passport. My wife's got a passport. I've got a house over there. I get back and forth whenever I can. I love the place to death.
Yes.
Yes, we want. I promise to take Mick Garone. We'll take Mick Garone.
And listen, have you a preference again? We asked you before, Italy or Uruguay?
I'm not really bothered. We're there. We're in the last eight for the first time in my history, and it's magic. I'm delighted for the lads.
Well done. Congratulations, sir. Cheers, thank you.
And good luck to the people back home.
Great.
Hope they have a good party.
I'm sorry. I am sorry. I should have warned you. We were going to play that bed again to open our Big Jack tribute podcast. Jack, in case you didn't hear that yesterday, that was him speaking to his friend Jimmy Arnfield on the BBC with music from the late Connor Walsh. Beautiful song called The Lucid. You're welcome to the show. Hi, Murph. That is a tearjerker. How are you?
Hey, Owen. Yeah, I'm just recovering over here. I mean, I've listened to it 7 or 8 times now, and yet every time I find myself choking up a little.
Hi, Ken. How are you doing?
Owen, how are you?
I'm good. I'm looking forward to this because there have been so many beautiful and touching tributes paid to Jack over the last few days, and so much has been said about his time as Ireland manager by this point. So as well as paying our own tribute to the man and to that era in this country, what we also want to do is go a bit deeper into Jack's roots in the coal mining town of Ashington near Newcastle. Himself and Bobby grew up in a famous football family. It's such an amazing story. And think about it, these two brothers driven on by their football mad mother, escaping a life down the pits by becoming professional players, winning a World Cup together. One of them becomes, I don't know, probably the most beloved English footballer of all time. One of them, the most beloved Irish sporting figure of all time. It's unbelievable, really. Here's Jack talking about the early days in an interview with Sue Lawley in October on Desert Island Discs in October 1996.
Well, the house was, we didn't have a bathroom. We had a kitchen. You went from the front door straight onto the main street. I mean, we had a bedroom upstairs, which was me and my father's, and then we had the big bedroom next door, which we had a double bed in, and Bobby, Gordon, Tommy and myself used to all sleep in it together in the winter. Not always in the summer, because we also had a single bed, but in the winter it was very cold. Who slept in the middle was what you always used to fight over, because that was the warmest spot. But who
got it?
Oh, usually me.
And you, as the oldest, did you have to look after the others?
Oh, yeah,
you
were very in much charge. So. Bobby particularly. I mean, Bobby was, I think there's about 2 years and 8 months between me and our kid. And I had to take him, traipse him around, look after him during the day, make sure that he was okay. And I didn't like it.
Why not?
Well, I like the sea. I like the countryside. I like to go bird nesting. I like to go picking blackberries. I like to go mushrooming. I like to go pick taties. And Bobby didn't. Bobby was more of a... He liked to play football, he liked to be around my mother, he liked to be at home. And when I had to drag him off somewhere, you know, I could have done more things without him than I could do with him.
Just Jack's hobbies in those days. I liked to pick taties.
Yeah.
Mushrooming, bird nesting, amazing.
Yeah, it's like a hilarious sort of like a rural idyll type list of, just a crazy list. It's like something out of Enid Blyton or something, you know?
You grew up in a house with four boys, Murph. Did you huddle together for warmth in the one double bed?
We didn't, Owen. We didn't. Jack has a, you know, well, he was 50 years older than me or whatever. About 50 years older than me. But no, we didn't. We still managed to fight about lots of things, but we didn't have to fight about who was in the middle of the four. I mean, I always would have thought that being on the edge would give a little bit more freedom of movement, maybe, but I bow to Jack's superior knowledge in this
area. Jack wanted the warmth in those cold Newcastle / Ashington winters. The relationship with himself and Bobby did grow more difficult, as you're aware, in later years. And we're going to talk about that with Jack's biographer, Colin Young, later on in the show. That quote from Jack, though, just to go back to the opening bed, because I don't want to just gloss over it. It's really interesting what he says about the criticisms of his style of play. And his response too. So he says a lot of the pundits didn't like it, but the teams that we played against hated it. And that's a great quote for a start. It wasn't only the pundits who had their doubts early on in Jack's time as Ireland manager, guys. I've got, it wasn't even one pundit in particular, because this is the way it's sort of been painted in the last few days. It was like Dunphy versus the world or Dunphy versus Jack. But it was a lot. Dunphy did actually, his views did represent the views of a lot of Irish football people. I've got a letter framed upstairs in my house, written by my uncle Ben, dated 4th of May 1987, and printed, I believe, in the Evening Herald later that week. This is the middle of the Euro 88 qualifying campaign, right? Well, what?
Oh, sorry, no, I love the idea of writing a letter to a newspaper about a football team.
Completely.
You know, it's,
and wait till you see the detail of it. Yes. It's brilliant. But he was a massive Ireland fan, used to go to all the away games. He'd bring back a scarf for me and a doll for my sister from places like Bulgaria. We'd be like, what the hell is Bulgaria? But thanks for the scarf and the doll. This is great stuff. So this is what he said, 4th of May 1987. Having attended all our Nations Cup matches to date, I suggest that Jack Charlton's inflexible use of the early ball time after time is all very well in the heated and torrid atmosphere of Sofia's Vasilevsky Stadium or the Heysel in Brussels, but surely at home we badly need a more considered, patient, cultured approach. Apart from this tactical naivety, doubts must also be raised about Jack's team selection. Loyalty is an admirable trait in itself, but sentiment has no place in football. I feel certain that if Guy Thys, the Belgian manager at the time, I believe, had opted for a more adventurous and bold style of play, then Klassen or Desmet could have embarrassed the slow, if lion-hearted, McCarthy. Remember what Preben Elkjær did to him in Copenhagen. against a back five, yes, five of the calibre of Gerrits, Groen, Albert, Verroot and Clijsters. I can't believe I'm having to do Belgian pronunciations.
Oh, no, I know.
My,
your
my biggest weakness
is...
as a broadcaster. Yeah. I stumbled through those ones. Okay, so aside from against the back five of that calibre, we were always going to be up against it. But the strikers were feeding off crumbs as far as clear-cut chances were concerned. Why then the constant long early ball to the head of Stapleton or Aldridge, invariably swept up by a Belgian in any case? And why was Galvin not substituted? I admire Jack Charlton. He has achieved a great deal in a short space of time, but I urge him in the future to provide for some measure of flexibility. So there's a couple of things on this, right? Just the passion and the tactical detail in that is wonderful. I think this is also pretty poignant for me and my family because my Uncle Ben died a few months after writing that. You know, you hear a lot of this, you hear a lot of people make the point the last few days that we were lucky to be around for Italia 90 and all the rest of it. And that point really did come home to me when I read that letter again on Saturday. And it's a lot of families, so many people involved in Irish football over the years, players and supporters. You know, they just weren't around to see the good times when they eventually arrived. I'm sure some people listening have that experience in their own families. So we really were the lucky ones to get to experience those glory years. And especially for the three of us talking here, that we were so young and so influenced by what we saw in those years. And all of it watched over by Big Jack Ken. But yeah, the point there is
that... At least your Uncle Ben now got to see Ireland beat Brazil 19 days after he wrote that letter.
Beating
a team that was able to bring Rai, Romario and Joao Paulo off the bench with a team who brought off
Romario
the bench.
Romario was playing.
Off the bench, Owen. Rai, Socrates' brother. Socrates couldn't make it. We, that day, brought off the bench Niall Quinn, Dave Langan and Ken Demange.
Ken Demange.
We interviewed Ken Demange. Yeah. I think that was his one and only cap, right? Maybe two caps.
I think he had two or three caps. Yeah, yeah.
I think he said a two-cap wonder or something. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so at least that would have been one of the good days, I guess.
But Jack is, even in the clip we played there, and I'd say a lot of people have heard a lot of clips along those lines, he's fully aware of the criticism that I think was mostly early on in his reign. But the way he explains it is quite clear. I think people have been quite impressed when you listen back that he did, while not everyone agreed with it, he did put a lot of thought into what he was doing. It wasn't, he really took umbrage in a lot of the interviews I've heard with this kick and rush, you know, the idea that it was kick and rush. So while a lot of Irish football people weren't mad on the style of play, there was a method to his madness.
Absolutely. And that's what I love about that clip because, I mean, well, there's a lot of things I love about the clip, but one of the things that I really like about it is how clearly he encapsulates in just a few words, what it is that he was trying to do, why he decided to do it that way. And when someone can explain something so clearly and concisely, it's only because they understand what they're talking about. They've thought about it. They've thought it through. And not only has he thought it through tactically in a football sense, but it's based also on psychological insight. It's taking account of it's holistic, as Manchester City's directors would say. It's taking account of the context, the conditions in which this team would be playing in front of in Ireland, on a bad pitch, with lots of Irish people watching, who are going to get excited if their players crash into a fullback. you know, they're going to get excited. The bloodlust.
Still do, Kent, to this day.
The bloodlust is going to be up. Yeah. The bloodlust is going to be up. So it's based on these sort of psychological insights. It's based also on, it's like a skeptics type of football. Like, it's founded on the insight that most players are not as good as they think they are. Like, if most people think they're above average drivers, imagine the egotism rampant among professional players, you know, all of whom are the vast majority of whom are guys in their 20s, you know, who think that they are God's gift to the world, and the inflamed egos of these people and the insane overestimation of their own capacity, which is what Jack Charlton's entire system of football was designed to exploit. You know, this is like, you are not as good as you think you are. And if we run chase after you, you will make a mistake and we will benefit. We will win the game. And, you know, so there's a lot of things that are gone into this. And I think a lot of the criticism was largely was focused too much on the single dimension of what's happening on the field. I mean, there's obviously all kinds of, well, you know, what specific things do we try to do when we get the ball, like the technical or tactical side of it, and not sort of taking account of the full sort of package of it, which I think is more multidimensional, has a lot of psychological factors, which I think Charlton understood better than some of the people who were criticizing him. Now, I'm not saying the Charlton system is perfect, but he's not saying it is either. I mean, if there's a criticism, it's that maybe he doesn't, and the criticism that stands against him. Because remember that, you know, it's there's people like your uncle, obviously, Eamon Dunphy, Giles. I mean, if you watch The Boys in Green recently, there's the clip from Giles at the start where he's like, I wouldn't talk to Jack Charlton about football. Like, he just doesn't take him seriously as a football person, a football mind at all. You know what I mean? Or is it? I'm not 100% sure if the way he says it makes it seem as though I just didn't take him seriously. I just didn't agree. I didn't agree with him so much. There was nothing to talk about with him.
I think that's what it was with Giles. They just disagreed so much. And as Giles said, there's a very good podcast with Giles Dunphy and Brady from a few weeks back on the stand, a while back was on Jack's 85th birthday. And Giles, I think it's more that they just disagreed so much on it. And the way Jack was never going to bend even an inch. So what was the point in having the conversation?
There was no point really in talking to him about it. But they obviously totally disagreed. And the criticism that stands, I think, is, look, you know, we had this team that played really well and you know, did really, I think Brady says it on that. Brady, of course, who was a victim really of Charlton, who was kind of felt as though Charlton was kind of against it from the outset. And the reason being that, you know, Brady was kind of getting towards the end of his career and wasn't really able to run. Wanted to play a different way. Anyway, wanted to be on the ball, wanted to be the playmaker for this team. Like in that clip, he says, everybody has a playmaker. Everyone wants to play through the playmaker. Now, Charlton looking at it is like, that playmaker, everyone else sees a sexy number 10. I see a bottleneck. I see a weak point. That's what that is. That's if I can sever this team at that point, then they fall apart. You know what I mean? Mm. Whereas to other people, I don't want to put word in Brady's mouth, but definitely people who, you know, somebody, for instance, like Brady, would be like, well, this is what the game is about. this is what the game is. Like,
it's,
you know,
weird.
Skillful players doing creative things with the ball. Whereas Charlton's like, nah, you know, the game's about winning the, I was actually unconsciously beginning to quote the song, the game's about being effective, yeah, being aggressive. No, the game is about winning. It's a results oriented thing. His way of looking at it, at the game, is very much looking at where the weaknesses are. Where are the weaknesses in the team? Where's the space? The space is behind the fullbacks. You know, what's the weaknesses that they all have? Well, they don't attack quickly and they all want to play through this one guy. You know what I mean? So it's all about analyzing the opponent and then responding to those weaknesses rather than saying, you know, the sort of the classic thing that a sort of a good team or skillful players say, oh, you know, just give us the ball and let them worry about us. You know, it's the opposite of that.
Mm. It's mad how, like, accurately he read the Mexico World Cup, because I was actually just watching, you know, the FIFA 1986 movie of that World Cup. And it's the entire thing is crafted around each team's playmaker. You know, so Francescoli, it's that's exactly what football was. And like that contrarian element that you need to understand as well that like he came into a culture that was just about failure, like all the time. Like Irish football was a story of failure up until he came. So even if at that moment, you know, a team based around Liam Brady as our number 10 and as our playmaker, you know, it might seem like it made a lot of sense looking at it from this distance. The fact of the matter is that it had failed, you know, that we had just constantly failed. And this idea that, right, okay, we're going to do it a different way. And I have it in granular detail how we're going to do it differently. Like, you know, when you're in a team that has failed and a guy comes in with a plan, you know, and not just like a vague plan. It's like, this is a very specific plan which makes us different to everyone else.
Even Giles said in that podcast a couple of months back, he echoed what you said there. He said, look, and they all said the same thing. They all felt maybe you could have had the same success or even more in another way, but you can't prove that. And what you can prove is that Jack came in, had a very, showed leadership, showed really clear leadership and got results and also was a decent guy. They all said the same thing, even though they all had their various altercations with him. They all said, oh, he's a good guy.
I mean, I think, you know, there is that criticism that, well, maybe his skepticism about the ability of players went too far and he couldn't recognize how good some of the players that he had, in fact, were, that they were capable of playing a more ambitious game. They were capable of taking more risks in the game they played. And and that's why Charlton, I think, was characterized by people who didn't like the approach, like Dunphy, obviously, most prominently, as this, like, kind of an awful, like this sort of authoritarian, repressive figure who's like stifling creativity, and you know, this drill sergeant, this sort of conservative tyranny, you know, which is kind of hard to, if you think about it now, the way that everybody sort of just remembers him with this nostalgic glow, you know, that people really didn't like this about him, you know, that he did seem like this horrible stifling authority figure. To people who were against him, obviously people who liked him thought he was great the whole time. And you know, the criticism would be made that, well, look, we had so many good players. That team was always going to have a great era. You know what I mean? Ireland was going to have an amazing era in football at that time anyway. With the players that we had, how could it not have happened? And yet the thing is that it hadn't happened. Like we couldn't qualify for anything. We were just, it's not as though when Charlton came in, things had already been developing in a promising direction. It seemed as though everything was just, you know, where are we going with it? Why does nothing ever work out for us? You know what I mean? Maybe you could say, well, things had gone so badly, we were reverting to the mean by becoming successful finally. But the fact is, it had never happened before. And he came along and had this idea. Now, it's not as though this team was always, you know, was some kind of irresistible force. It was a bit like, I guess, the way Iceland have been over in recent years. You know, it was a bit like that, where you get a team with a clear game plan that's able to beat more fancy teams. But, like, there was a lot of times you'd be looking at this team and going, we are never going to score a goal. Like, how many times did that happen? You know, the only time I can think of where I remember watching the Ireland team for a long spell in a big game, thinking we are definitely going to get a goal here, was against England. If you remember the game against England at Wembley in 1991, when Niall Quinn eventually scored. Yep. But like, there was just this incredible spell of pressure. England had scored quite early, like after 10 minutes or something. The shot went in off Steve Staunton, Lee Dixon shot went in off Steve Staunton. But then there was just this incredible spell of pressure for, like, I don't know, it seemed to go on about 3 hours. It couldn't have, but it was like, it was the one time I remember thinking, wow, you know, we're definitely going to score at some point. Should have ended up winning the game, obviously missed the more often I remember watching and thinking, it's never gonna happen. Like, I remember thinking that against Holland in the World Cup, and then this miracle goal arrives out of nowhere. I mean, if you think about it, the nemesis team for Jack Charlton was Holland in 1988, in 1994, and again in his last game in 1995. They're the opposite team to the type of football that he was playing. They are the ultimate, they're the incarnation of his you know, the antithetical approach to Charlton's approach in football. It's like, we are actually as good as we think we are. We have got inflamed Dutch egos, and you wouldn't believe how crazy those egos are and how out of control they are. However, we are seriously good. We are seriously good players.
Van Basten, hold it. You're not as good as you think you are. Oh, we are.
Oh, but we are. Overmars, Bergkamp, you know, Davids and Seedorf and Kluivert in the last game. I mean, we all remember what happened with all the, you know, the egos. A few noses got out of joint in the camp. Euro 96 ended up going really badly for that Dutch team. But against us, against our sort of old team, full of fullbacks, as I recall that night, they just made us look like, they made us look like farm animals. You know what I mean? It was that bad. Like, it was like, oh God. But, you know, sometimes you come up against a team that actually is really good. And in that case, you got to step back and go, well, look, you could criticize the tactics, but I think we probably would have lost that game anyway.
Yeah, our players were past their best by that stage. Yeah. Well. And the Dutch all seemed to be, they all seemed to be 18. I mean, I know they weren't that young, but it felt like they were all 18, yeah, just running rings around us. But that's that for now. Just a funny postscript to that letter my uncle had published a few days later. Another of my uncle's, one of his brothers, wrote into the paper himself with a rebuttal. It was like, dear sirs, or whatever, I'd like to take issue with the points raised by Brendan in last week's letter, just to wind up the younger brother, which I quite liked. Speaking of brothers, Big Jack and Bobby, if you get the chance, by the way, you really should go back and listen to Jack on Desert Island Discs. Some nice choices: Dubliners, Furies, Christy Moore, and the rest of it. But the most captivating part of the interview is when Sue Lawley gets into that difficult relationship Jack had with his younger brother.
All of that success in Ireland was perhaps even more important to you than it might have been, because it was the first time you'd stepped out from behind the shadow of your younger brother, that you did something, you achieved something that he never did.
Not really. I mean, I achieved pretty well. I won competitions that he didn't win. He won competitions that I didn't win. But we had, as far as winning things and putting things on the table, I did as well with Leeds United as he did with Manchester United.
But he never managed a team.
We prepared ourselves in a different way. I was always a coach. I went through my Lily Show days, and I went through all my sessions, and I'd spend years and years and years until they made me a staff coach at the age of about 27. I always wanted to go into management. I'm not sure that our kid was prepared properly for what it was like to make the decisions. When you get involved in coaching, you've got to make the decisions. And maybe in my character that's a little bit different. I don't know. But jealousy, no. I was sorry that he didn't make it in management. I wish he had. I wish he had made it in management. You know, we would probably be better friends if he had done. I mean, him moving away and going to be a director and to be looking for the higher echelons of the game of football is maybe what has pushed us apart a little bit over the years. Maybe if we'd had something in common, like problems of being a manager over a period of 20-odd years, maybe we would have been better friends. Who knows?
Your mother died earlier this year, and I think that most people remember you four Charlton boys carrying her coffin. And people will also remember talk of a rift in the family, that Bobby hadn't seen her before.
I don't really want to get involved with that, Sue. Bobby did what Bobby wants to do. I mean, it was strange to me. I couldn't understand why there was a rift between Bobby and my mother. I couldn't understand it. And I really don't understand it to this day. From being very much a homeboy and a lad that was his mother's, apple of his mother's eye, suddenly he just stopped going home. I don't know why.
And has that damaged your relationship with him as well?
Oh, I think so. I think so.
How deeply damaged?
Only time will tell. I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't ignore him. I walk in and I have ignored him on the odd occasion. But I regret that. That's silly. That's silly. Life's too short to argue about things like that.
And he's still our kid.
He's still our kid, and he's still my brother, and I'm sure one of these days we'll either have a good fight or we'll have a good argument over it.
And they did. They did come back together. I'm not sure if things were ever brilliant between them, but they certainly improved towards the end. One man who can tell us more about all of this is Colin Young. I think we all felt we knew Jack Charlton pretty well simply by being around and the years when he managed the Irish football team. But Colin knew him better than most, having written Jack's official biography in 2016. Colin, it's been a while. Great to chat to you again.
You too, guys. Thanks for having me on.
What was, well, how far back does, I mean, that book was towards the end of his life. How far back did your relationship with Jack Charlton go?
I got to know him actually just after he'd left Ireland. I didn't cover the Republic until 96, 97, which is obviously when Mick had taken over. But I got to know him simply by flying from the Northeast to Ireland. And often he'd be with John and Pat and having, you know, just a match-related trip to Ireland, which usually would be a week to 2 weeks long and involved fishing and other activities. And so, yeah, I got to know him on a personal level, really, around about that time. And then being up in the Northeast, you couldn't help but bump into him at matches and dinners and all kinds of things. And then I was just approached at around about the time that the family were actually looking to reprint Peter Byrne's original 1996 biography, which he ghost wrote. There were difficulties over reprinting and copyrights and so on. So we just decided to kind of do it afresh, but with not new stories, because a lot of them had been told before, but hopefully newer stories, or a retelling of stories from a different perspective or by different people. And the fog had started to descend a little bit on Jack's memories at that time. And I think he found it more beneficial and enjoyable to actually listen to other people telling the stories and use them as a prompt for him to try and reminisce and so on. So it was just a lovely time actually to get to know him and in the calmness of his son John's pub up near Blythe and spend a bit of time in his company. And as I've said in one of the tributes I wrote at the weekend, he's one of those figures where actually it was just a privilege to have met him, never mind have the opportunity to put your name to the book of his life.
I was interested in that, in how that worked, that sort of working relationship between you and him, if you want to call it that, because as you say, his memory was going by that stage, and I guess it wouldn't be as straightforward as just you asking him a string of stuff. He wasn't in a position to recall those sort of details, but he still, that can be, I'm sure that can be frustrating for people in that situation, but the fact that you got other people involved and you had a good relationship with him, it sounds like he enjoyed the process rather than finding it difficult.
Yeah, I knew from fairly early on when I met him and Pat a couple of years earlier that, as I say, the mental capacity and the actual enjoyment from his own point of view of remembering stories had lessened somewhat. So obviously people who get to that stage of life, if it becomes too much of a strain to them or that they feel under pressure because they can't remember the finite details of a story, and obviously in his case there are so many of them, you're right, trying to find an environment, and it was invariably around the house or at John's pub, and it would just be over lunch having fish and chips with me, Pat, my wife Leslie, and John and his wife Dee, and we'd just sit and chew the cud, as it were, and just let the stories kind of flow. So one of the most memorable days, my wife and I were talking about this the other day, was when we were just sat having fish and chips, and we were talking about Jack and Pat meeting. And I guess like every couple, the story is always slightly different from the female perspective, or she might be sharper in the memory of that particular meeting anyway. But it was funny listening to her tell the story and telling him off when he couldn't remember certain aspects of it and that kind of thing.
Well, how were they differing in their interpretations of how they met?
Just in terms of why Jack was there, was in the dance hall in the first place, and whether he was truly interested in only Pat Kemp or whether he'd been there previously and there were other other visits that she was unaware of and this kind of thing. So it was just little things, really. And I think, but the abiding memory actually of the lunch was that he kept nicking my wife's chips. And so she's trying to eat fish and chips. Pat's telling stories, blah, blah, blah. Jack's winking at Leslie and nicking chips. And then sort of halfway through it, she says, "Pat, he keeps nicking my chips, you know." And she said, "I know. And the daft thing is, he thinks we can't see him." And I think that there were, in many ways, that was just Jack. You know, there were little things that he would do when he met people, when he met kids in car parks asking for autographs, and it would be the daft little naughty wicked sense of humour stuff that set him apart from other football figures that people would meet, that made him such a unique person, I think. And as I say, spending that time with him and having those little lunches and stuff like that was such a joy. And genuinely, one of the things that I said over the weekend was the day that I went fishing with him really was one of the best days of my life. It was just an absolute joy from start to finish. But it was, to him, it was just a simple day out having a fish, which is probably the thing he loved more than football. But to me, it was just obviously a day in the life with a legend.
I often wondered about that, Colin, the hunting, or fishing and shooting that he used to do. And I can't remember where I read a comment or him talking about, you know, his father. My father was a pitman. He used to go shooting. He was talking about how he would, you know, he'd go and wait for these birds to like come in over the North Sea, you know, and I was thinking to myself, is this a kind of a normal thing to do? These are very country squire pursuits in my head. You know what I mean? I'm kind of seeing a mental image of a guy wearing a tweed jacket, much like the kind that Jack Charlton would wear when he became a rich and famous man, going around with a shotgun. How many people from like the coal mining background in Ashington were into these types of country squire pursuits?
I would think in the generation of Jack and his family that probably a very, very high percentage, because it wasn't done in many cases back then when Sissy was bringing them up and Bob was the one who was going out in the fields. It wasn't done for fun. It was done for food. It was putting food on a table. So when they would go out and catch hares and rabbits, it was to feed the family. And from that, I guess, in people like Jack's case, when they were brought up, it was something that you either pursued to help put food on the table. And if it became a hobby on top of that, then great. And I think that the basis of what Jack enjoyed, which was just going out in the country for hours and hours on end, and if that meant interrupting a training session, as he did once at Newcastle when he was told there was trout on the Tyne by his mates who bowled up to the training ground in a car, and Jack jumped straight into the back and left the players to it.
Jack was supposed to be doing a training session and his mates arrive up and
yeah,
say...
He was halfway through a training session at Newcastle. His mate bowls up in his car, you know, like speeds onto the training ground, screeching into the car park, shouts across to Jack, "Jack, there's trout on the Tyne, come on," and he was off. Now, I think that was a reflection of how poorly he was doing at Newcastle at the time, or certainly how indifferent he was to the difficulties the club were having. But equally, I think it just speaks volumes for how much he genuinely loved the outdoors and hunting. And as I say, in his brother's case, one of his brothers anyway, Bobby, he never really took to hunting. He wanted to go out and play football when he was an adolescent and growing up and work on his technique and his speed and his pace with one of his uncles. Jack was happier messing around on a beach or getting up at 5 a.m. to trap rabbits or whatever it was. And I think undoubtedly one of the benefits that he saw when he took the island job was the fact that it's not short of spaces for him to go and fish.
Yeah, I heard John Giles and Eamon Dunphy talking about him recently, talking about Jack, and I can't remember whether it was, I think it might have been Dunphy, one of them said that he wasn't sure that Jack really loved the game.
Liam Brady,
Brady.
It was Brady's made that point, yeah. Yeah,
yeah.
It was a means to an end, he felt, where fishing was the passion.
He was saying, he wasn't sure like if he was really a kind of obsessed by football in the way that some people involved in football are, or some people who aren't involved in football are, that you know, he did it to get paid, and actually he was more interested in other things. Does that match what you know of him?
You're telling me that, Ken, and I'm sort of shaking my head, and I'm not 100% sure that's entirely accurate. I think that the the basis of it being a means for him to earn money and to do well in life, I think that's true. I think that if he could have made a profession or a living out of fishing and other aspects of the outdoor life, I suspect he would have ticked that box first. But I think that also it shouldn't be forgotten that if he hadn't become a professional footballer and taken the opportunity to join Leeds at the age of 15 and it all went swimmingly and he ended up getting to the levels that he did in terms of winning medals and leagues and becoming their record appearance holder, he would have ended up down the pit. And that life and that alternative to what he achieved, I don't think that ever left him. I don't think that he ever forgot how fortunate he was. And I think the other thing that makes me think that perhaps it's a little bit unfair is that when he was a Leeds player, he did his coaching badges or whatever it was at that stage really, really early. He was still playing. And in his early 20s, when he'd qualified as a coach, and he was still playing at Leeds and doing coaching sessions with kids on a morning at schools and whatever, and then driving or walking to Elland Road to do a training session with the players, and then in the afternoon would do more coaching sessions. So it's not there was a practicality, yes, but I think there was undoubtedly a love of the game. Which never left him. He loved the game. I've absolutely no question of it. But if he gave the impression that he was slightly indifferent to it, that was probably part of the clever act that Jack put on when he needed to, whether he was over here or over in Ireland.
You've mentioned Bobby a few times, and you know you can't tell the full story of Jack without talking about his brother. It's remarkable these two guys came from the same family, the same household, the same bed. I believe I heard Jack talking about this in the Desert Island this interview. The four brothers slept not just in the same room, but in the winter they slept in the same bed together for warmth. So this is the kind of upbringing, and yet you've already highlighted some of their different interests. We hear about the complex relationship that they had as adults. Did that all come later, or was the relationship never totally straightforward even as kids?
I don't think it was ever straightforward. Well, no, probably, actually. It was pretty straightforward as kids, which was that Jack was older, he was taller, and he liked going outside and hunting after fish or whatever. And Bobby was the younger one. And bearing in mind, I think the two brothers had possibly come along when they'd started to properly be old enough to be allowed to go out on the streets on their own. So Bob's down the pit working, and Sissy's looking after the two other boys, Tommy and Gordon. And I think there was
So Bob Senior's down the pit.
Sorry. I think there was an element of Jack being the babysitter and being told, look after our Bobby today. And Bobby basically being a little bit of a whiny child who didn't really want to go messing around in rivers and hunting after rabbits. So it was straightforward in that regard, in that they didn't always get on as kids. And certainly, I think Jack, if you listen to interviews, would admit that his brother was basically a bit of a pain in the arse. But he was given the job of babysitting him. As they got older, and Jack got the deal at Leeds, and Bobby obviously became one of the legends of the game at Manchester United, I think they were close. And I think that because they had the two careers going side by side, I think that they became quite close at that point as they left home and became older. But then wives and come into the equation, children, your own children come into the equation. So they naturally drifted apart. And I certainly think that there was a contrast, not just in the brothers, but also in the wives, in that Sissy was very close to Pat. They watched the games in 66 together. They watched probably most of Jack's home and away matches at Leeds together, sitting in the stands together. And Norma, Bobby's wife, didn't really bother and didn't really get on with Sissy. And again, in his various books that he's written, Bobby Charlton has admitted there were difficulties in the relationship between those three and four and five, if you add all the wives, and that he was effectively given a little bit of a choice between the two women in his life and chose his wife. That annoyed and disappointed Jack, I think. It led to a bit of a chasm between them. They were reconciled later in life. They were reconciled when I was writing the book, but they were never close. And I think that that is the same as many, many families. We all go through, I think, periods where we have a little bit of a fallout with one of our siblings or mum and dad or whatever. And it isn't as high profile, obviously, as the Charlton family. And from a brotherly point of view, there aren't many brothers who get to hug on the pitch at Wembley in 1966, having just won the World Cup final, and who are the first brothers to win that competition, the biggest, obviously, in world football. And because we've got that image of them, because we knew that they came and brought up together and played in the same team together, I guess everybody just wanted or assumed that they would be close forever. And obviously, as I say, they're no different to any other family in having the odd fallout and the odd disagreement, and a belief from Jack that while he spent the latter years of Sissy's life looking after her with Pat, Bobby perhaps didn't play his role in that regard.
Yeah, and I'm sure, well, it seems pretty clear that Bobby was unhappy with Jack, maybe for him talking about all that in his first book and interviews around that. I think that's fair to say as well. It cut both ways, in the sense that maybe Bobby was disappointed with Jack airing the dirty linen in public.
Quite probably, but I think that that Jack's argument would definitely be, well, that's the truth, and why should I hide it? You know, I don't imagine for one minute that that was a long argument. If they ever had that discussion, Jack would, I'm sure, have justified that with, well, it's true.
Do you think that Jack was a little bit jealous of Bobby?
No, I generally don't, kind of, because I think, again, listening to the interviews over the weekend, he knew that Sir Bobby was a better footballer. He was one of the best footballers in the world, let's be honest, of that generation.
The reason it occurs to me is I watched that Parkinson interview he did. You know, the one when Jack is wearing the purple suit? I think it's 1972. Yeah. And he's like 37-year-old Jack. And 37-year-old Parkinson as well, it turns out. Sure. Better 37-year-olds are talking about all this. And Parkinson says, oh, you know, your kid. So they're talking about Bobby. And what... The way Jack talks about him is a little bit strange. He's like, I'd love to be able to play like him, but he's almost sort of, he's, even then there's something slightly awkward in the way he's talking about him. Like he's obviously admiring of his skill, but it seems almost he's quite specific that he admires the skill as opposed to the rest of the brother.
The person.
Yeah.
That may be easier now to look back at that interview and put it in that perspective. Do you know what I mean? But I think that as a person, I don't think he felt jealous of him. And as a footballer, he probably did. But then he accepted from a very young age, I'm sure, that he was a completely different class of footballer.
See, there's a thing that comes up in that where he says, he kind of says in a way, like almost acknowledges that he sort of benefited from being Bobby's brother.
Right.
Like that Bobby is like the genius, you know? And I guess at some point someone said, oh, hang on, you're telling me this genius has a brother? You know, where's the brother? You know what I mean?
He's like 6'5". What the hell?
it turns out the brother's quite different. But like, was there a sense that like, that's sort of, he had, you know, he even sort of refers to it in that interview. And this is like him, you know, at the end of his career, and he's achieved a lot in his own right. But there's still this sense that maybe being Bobby's brother helped to smooth his path.
Quite possibly. But I think that in the period since then, if you think about it, Bobby Charlton was a failed football manager. I mean, he failed catastrophically as a football manager. Jack didn't. With the exception of the Newcastle year, everywhere he went, he sprinkled a bit of gold dust. And the teams at Middlesbrough, I know from my own experience, and certainly at Sheffield Wednesday, are remembered really, really fondly as two kind of legendary sides. And obviously what he went on to achieve in Ireland is, you know, we don't need to discuss that. But Bobby failed as a manager at Preston. And then became a what he became as a kind of diplomat, whatever, at Manchester United. And in the, you know, in the interim period, there's no comparison from what they achieved in football. But I think the other thing that's worth remembering and acknowledging with Bobby Charlton is, of course, the Munich air disaster, which, from what I have read and heard, changed him as a person, in terms of he found it very difficult, really, and still does, I think, to come to terms with the fact that he survived, that guilt of surviving. And he became probably more withdrawn. And I think that we all know what an ebullient and wonderful and funny character Jack was, in contrast. And he was like that right until the end. And he, you know, you'd go to the pub and he still lit up the room. Mm-hmm. He was just, he had that presence about him, which I don't think Bobby Charlton had. And I think that when it comes to an overall picture of, going back to your original question, kind of whether he was jealous of him, I don't think he would be, because I think he would, and other people would reflect that he was probably the nicer person. And I think that that part of it is probably more important to Jack than anything.
Jack, you mentioned the fact of Bobby's failure to become a great manager, or a manager of any note. Jack actually put that down as a reason at one point for them potentially being a straight. He said him moving into being a director into the higher echelons of football pushed us apart a bit over the years. Maybe if we had something in common like the problems of being a manager over a period of 20 years, maybe we'd have been better friends. Who knows? I mean, that's a hypothetical, because nobody knows what that it didn't happen that way. And maybe there was obviously more to it than just one of them being a good manager and one of them not. So we don't have to worry too much about that. But I did want to ask you if you ever felt that Jack, maybe it was a bit too late by the time you were talking to him, but for the book, but at any stage over the years, did he ever communicate to you his hurt over those lost years of his relationship with his brother?
No, and probably the opposite. As I say, they were reconciled, but they were never particularly close. And I don't think he saw that any different, because he was just our kid. He was just his brother. And it was a normal brotherly relationship from that perspective, just the same as any other family. And at the end of the day, family was extremely, extremely important to Jack, and more important.
But I know families fall out. Yeah. I don't want to be naive about this. I have a sister. I don't have a brother. But I can't imagine. I don't see a scenario myself. My sister, touch wood, don't talk basically for years and years. So it seems a bit more than just the average. Two brothers having a row. These are two guys who achieved so much together.
But that's the point I'm making.
For many years, couldn't sit down and have a pint with each other, yeah?
I think that's the point I'm making. Just because they achieved so much together doesn't then therefore lead to them having to be close as brothers. And I think there is this assumption that because of the success that they had together, that they had to be close and together for the rest of their lives. And they just drifted apart, and around about the time that Sissy passed, they had a fallout and then were reconciled. I know what you're saying, that if you try and compare it to your own family, you might think, well, I can never imagine not actually talking to my brother for so many months or years or however long it is. But they were just very, very different men. And it also geographically lived so far apart as well. Jack made Northumberland his home when he got the Newcastle job and lived up here for 30, 40 odd years. And Bobby's probably only been back a handful of times. And most of those are actually probably as Manchester United ambassador, when you could wonder if he'd ever pop up to Ashington and knock on the door and ask how the family are. And I don't think he ever has. And I think that's just the way he is.
They did have the Sports Personality of the Year moment, which was nice, though, wasn't it, Colin?
Well, it was lovely. I watched that over the weekend. I think one of the most telling things, actually, if you watch it, is Bobby's reaction when Jack is talking and is, I guess, the bigger man at that point in terms of putting himself forward, because there was probably no guarantee that he was actually going to be willing to do it. But I think that, as I say, you only have to watch Bobby to see how much it meant to him to have his big brother there.
It certainly sounds like Jack stayed very close to his roots, Colin. And one story I've seen touched on over the last few days, but I have to say I know nothing about, is his support for the miners in the miners' strike. Was there a story there?
Well, you're right. I think that it comes that support for the mining community. He was in Sheffield at the time, down in South Yorkshire, which was obviously a massive part of the UK coal scene. And it was devastated by the industrial action and the whole campaign, the whole strike and everything that came with it. And at his soul, he was a miner's son. In fact, he very, very nearly became a miner. He lasted one shift, said he didn't want to go down the pit again. He kind of had an interesting relationship with mining, actually, because his initial job was just to sit at the top of the pit above ground, where he basically kind of looked after wagons that flew past tons of coal on them. And he didn't have to do a great deal. And in fact, I think he spent most of his time trying to catch birds, going back to the original part of our conversation, and just messing around in the outdoors. Yeah. And then one day the foreman came up to him and basically said, you do know there's a training course and you do know you've got to go down that shift and in that lift. And he lasted one shift and said, I am not going back down there. And I think that that's one of the driving things in his life, and we touched on it, is how important football was to him. Given what the alternative was, there was just no way he was going to be a miner, but he was of mining stock. So when he was in South Yorkshire and in the heart of that industrial action and that horrible time for many, many working class men around Britain, he was very, very much on the miner's side. Arthur Scargill, who lived nearby in their village near Barnsley, apparently became a really close family friend. Him and Jack would go off to the pub for a couple of pints before and after the strike, and struck up a really close friendship. And Pat acknowledged that in the book. It was one of the things that she talked about at length. And it was a regret of mine that despite efforts to try and approach the guy, that I never got a contribution from Arthur Scargill on what that friendship was like and what it meant to them. But from the Charltons' point of view, their support has never been forgotten in that area. And I think that that would be remembered by Barnsley, Rotherham, Sheffield United or Sheffield Wednesday fans as being an integral part of why he is such a popular figure around there.
How did the support manifest itself? What exactly did he do?
It was simple things like that. Apparently they had a big chest freezer in their garage, and Jack and Pat arranged for the mining families to have it. So it was taken from their house, and as you can imagine, it wasn't done quietly. There was a fair bit of the publicity, or you know, it was quite well known. So people knew that he was offering that kind of support, and he lent them a car. The local pit, basically, there wasn't many fellas who could run a car at that point, afford to or whatever. And he lent his car for anybody that needed it for either, shall we say, going to other pits to continue the protest, or if it was just bombing about the village because they needed to get some messages, whatever it was. The car was availed to the mining community, and it was just simple things like that that people knew, but which I'm sure Jack and Pat would have felt was just a natural thing for them to do, because it was the only kind of thing that they could practically do to help. And it's certainly never been forgotten in that area. But then, as I say, it comes, I'm sure, from his background and the soul of the miner beating through him, really.
Yeah, I mean, I guess he would feel that way because obviously this is the community he was from, and you know, the loyalty to the people that he grew up with and all this kind of thing. But I also wonder about the fact that he didn't want to go down that mine, you know? Like, no. I'm sure he wasn't the only one who felt that way. It's an interesting thing about these mining communities, because the you know, they always have I can't say I've got personal experience of a lot of mining communities in my life. When you read about them, hear about them, there's this kind of strong sense of community identity. The mine is kind of bringing the identity. It's obviously the economic backbone of the community, but it's also kind of a horrific thing. like a pit that you go down like thousands of feet below the ground. You know, there's all the reasons why people might, you know, really, there might be real solidarity down there, because there has to be, because there's like this, there's the danger of death. Everybody's kind of got to be able to count on everybody else. But like, nobody really wants to be down there. You know.
No, and so I think, sorry.
No, it's just the fact that he kind of said, look, I'm not doing it. I'm sorry. I want to fish. I want to shoot. I want to play football. I do not want to be down in that hole. That, like, people mightn't have really, really taken very kindly to people who were down that hole 8 hours a day, 6 days a week, might have been a little bit like, oh, you know, here's this guy thinks he's better than us.
Possibly. I mean, I think his father was very disappointed because he was, again, of mining stock. And the fact that Jack decided, he basically said to the foreman, there is no way you're getting me to go down there again. I quit. So walked out after day one of his training course. And the alternative, and bear in mind, he was only 15, by the way. The alternative that he came up with was to become a policeman. And on the day of his interview for Northumberland Police, it was actually a Friday. The day after, he had arranged or had been invited to a trial at Elland Road at Leeds United against Newcastle. But obviously transport in the mid-50s meant that it was one or the other. You couldn't do a day's induction at Northumberland Police and then hop on jump in the car, which they didn't have, hop on a bus. There was no trains from Ashington, fully enough, that took you direct to Leeds. So it was one or the other. And it was only Sissy, kind of, again, she was, of all of the family, absolutely obsessed with football, who said, all right, give it a go and see how you get on. And from there, obviously, the legend was born. But I think that clearly in mid-50s, Ashington Pit, I don't think health and safety was kind of the number one priority. It was kind of taken that if you put yourself down the pit, that you were absolutely right, putting yourself at risk and putting yourself in danger of death. And I live up in Durham now, and obviously this whole area, it was devastated by the miners' strike. There isn't a pit head other than in museums or by the side of football grounds at the Stadium of Light, kept as mementos. The whole thing has gone completely, but you only have to walk around cemeteries and graveyards and see the number of gravestones that are dedicated to young boys and grown men who died in a certain village's pit disaster of certain years. So everybody knew when they took on that vocation that they were putting themselves in danger, and quite a lot of the time were working on seams that basically hadn't been mined yet. So that required an enormous explosion in the dark, in the pit. And, you know, it was a horrific way to earn a living, and was their living. But as you say, it was bred into them. You know, Bobby Robson's family, and he served down the pit very, very briefly. And I certainly think that if you were to do a proper sociological historical look at the whole thing, I'm sure one of the reasons why Northeast footballers were so strong and so prevalent around about the time of Jack's era and before and after was because the alternative was that if you weren't decent at kicking a bag of air around, you were going to end up down the pit with your dad and your granddad before him. So I think it was a major driving force for young men to stay out of the pit, to become an athlete, become a footballer, and do something which, let's be honest, most of the men up here absolutely adored doing.
So before we let you go, Colin, I don't want to skate over the fact that you actually did get to spend an afternoon fishing with Jack Charlton. We all know the football side of things. We all hear this and that about the fishing. What is that experience actually like? Is there much chat, or do you just both sit there in comfortable silence and hopefully catch one fish by the end of the day?
Well, it was slightly different, and it was one of the reasons why I wanted to do it, which was that at this point, he'd lost his driving licence after a fall and through ill health. So he'd lost with that his independence, which was extremely important to him because he loved nothing more than obviously waking up on a bright sunny morning and deciding at six he was going to go to such and such a part of the River Tyne and spend all day there, and Pat would have his tea when he got home. taking away that independence was a huge blow to him. So he befriended a guy who he arranged to help out. They sold tea in Northumberland, so he put his face on the tea packet box, and in exchange got lifts to fishing venues across the northeast. So Bill Logan, the fella, actually made and devised a belt which would enable the pair of them to either sit in a river, stand in a river, or sit by the side of a lake. Debbie, his daughter, also helped with a custom-made chair. So everything was kind of geared around a slightly different fishing experience for him and for the viewer. But it was more the fact that we met quite early in the morning. Bill picked us both up. So I was just sat in the back, and that was the day that he turned round to me and called me, it's the laird with the book, which is what I became known as, which I just absolutely loved. I mean, there was an element of, crikey, can't even remember my name, but equally there was a part of, I'm so pleased to be known as the laird with the book, because he did have that lovely, way of speaking and saying certain words with his Northumberland accent. So I just sat in the back of the car, and we bought pies. We went to a section of the river, and it had rained the night before, and I wasn't totally sort of au fait with what goes on a fisherman's day out, but if apparently the River Tyne is running at about 3,000 miles an hour, then you're not going to be fishing it. And I remember finding this really nice section that he loved fishing. And he looked at the river. We got out of the car, looked at the river, and he said, oh, I can't believe it. I've never seen it like that before. And I'm looking at this river thinking, what, you've been coming here for 50-odd years, Jack. You're not telling me that you've never seen it like this before. But honestly, it was just a torrent of brownness flying past us. So there was no way we were going to fish it. So we went to a lake, and the preparations that he undertook to get these flies ready, to have the absolute right fly for the certain conditions, for the certain lake that we were going to, the 13 boxes in Bill's car boot that he knew exactly where each fly was, and if it was a yellow and blackish one, he knew exactly which tin to go in. The tins were like little inscribed things from places like Cork, Legion Club or whatever. So it was just little details like that, and just watching him, bearing in mind, as I say, he was 81, I think, 82 at that point. And the mental side of things were tough for him. But watching him and his fingers, and bearing in mind he'd lost half of one, watching him put the fly on and knowing exactly what he was doing. And Bill said, I'd never seen it. It was so delicate and intricate. And Bill said he'd been fishing for 30 odd years, never seen anybody able to show that much care and precision in doing that thing. And he said he could do it one handed, and it was one thing that he knew Jack would never be able to lose that ability to do it. So I say it was such a simple thing. It wasn't perhaps maybe as nice as being able to sit with him for 3 hours and do a huge section on the book on, I don't know, Italia 90 or whatever. But it was a day I'll never forget, and it was just lovely to sit and watch and witness it, and, as I say, be the laird with the book in the back of the car that just sat and kept the pies warm.
Beautifully told, Colin. Listen, thank you so much, and obviously people can have a read of the book if they get a chance. Really appreciate that today. Thank you so much.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
If you said black, he'd say white. If you said white, he'd say black.
Well, there was a suggestion that there was sort of an all-you-can-eat sort of a thing going on.
You can't argue with people like that. When
you were in the fall, Jack, if I can start by asking you, when you took over the Republic of Ireland job, did you set out any particular aims for yourself and for the team? Just
like an angel. It's the best thing in the world for you because it's full of protein. You can have one drink, no more, and then you're back to the hotel and you're off to bed.
There's been suggestions recently that there was no major problem with what players did a couple of days before a game. I wish I was special.
But we always, on the way back, the lads would start to sing, "We love you, Jackie, we do." Which meant, "Can we stop for a pint?" But I'm a creep.
I'm a winner. Jack, I want to ask you about Brian Kerr. Were the hotels besieged by fans and all that sort of thing when they went out on the town? Now, I want to get your thoughts on this because times certainly seem to have changed over the last 10 or 15 years as regards player preparation and the rest of that.
Not at all. I don't like people like him.
Back in your time, there was that famous Harry Ramsden's challenge, which has been talked about many times, and there was a suggestion that there was sort of an all-you-can-eat sort of a thing going on.
All-you-can-eat sort of a thing going on.
And we came back into Dublin, and when we were coming in, I said to the lads, "Do you want some fish and chips?"
With all the Celtic Tiger and everything that's happened in Ireland, that we've actually changed as a people.
It was more of it than anything else. I was at Harry Ramsden's the other night, and it was brilliant.
And we're more selfish, maybe, and a bit more mean and a bit more greedy.
So we stopped for fish and chips. What's wrong? Whatever you want. Stopping for fish and chips the day before a game. You're so fucking special. You get a plate full of fish and chips and you eat the fish and chips if you want them. Nobody had any soup to start with, nobody had any puddings to finish with. They had fish and chips. And I like fish and chips. And the players like the fish and chips. I think it was because the following day we lost the game. No, you can't blame fish and chips for losing the game.
No.
Can you?
For News Talk 106 Sport, I'm Owen McDevitt.
There have been so many nice little stories told over the last few days, and one of them was by Tony Cascarino in a Sunday Times article, and he said that he was taking the piss out of, I've heard a couple of variations of this story, but basically he was taking the piss out of somebody wearing a wig. He was taking the piss out of wigs, and
it was Jack, Burt Reynolds.
Yes, but then I think in Cass's own in the story he was talking about his own dad or something. But yeah, I did see Burt Reynolds mentioned elsewhere.
This was in Kimmage's piece about it in the Sunday Independent, I think, and he mentioned Cascarino's like, check out Burt's syrup of figs his wig. But he said his dad had had a wig and he could spot them anywhere.
Oh, okay. Sorry. So, yeah. So, the Burt Reynolds and the dad thing, about right.
Cascarino could pick out a wig at 150 pace.
One of his many talents, Tony Cascarino. So, Charlton overhears this and he's like, "Hey, you don't take the piss. Our kid has lost his hair and it caused him all sorts of bother." Obviously about Bobby, which I think is a very revealing quote in two ways. Well,
was he talking about Bobby or was he talking about himself?
But this is it. I think that quote shows how much he cares about Bobby.
Yeah.
Even in the times when that was presumably at a time when they weren't really speaking, but also how little he recognized about his own imperfection. He doesn't even notice that he's never exactly had a massive head of hair.
No, when Jack looked in the mirror, he saw Robert Plant looking at him. You know, he just, you know, don't take the piss out of bald people. What about our kid?
Yeah, our kid.
I'm going to have to get this under control.
I've never seen Bobby. You know? No, you know, yeah. Oh man, it's brilliant. Let's end the Jack Bobby chat on a positive. Here's the moment that we referenced during our conversation there when Jack presented Bobby with his BBC Sports Personality of the Year Lifetime Achievement Award.
When we were kids and we used to go to the park and play, I would go home for dinner and he'd stay on all day. Bobby Charlton is the greatest player I've ever seen. Isn't it, brother?
Yeah, simple and beautiful from Jack. I don't know if there will be a dry eye by the end of this podcast, to be honest with you, but we soldier on. It's the moment you've all been waiting for. Or at least World Service member Michael Friel has been waiting for. Surely, he says, the full unedited Young Owen Big Jack interview needs to be released in tribute. Whew. I think I'm ready for this. This is, you know, listening back to yourself in your very early days broadcasting. But it's not about me. It's about Jack, guys. So we should probably do this.
Yeah, let's go for it.
Yeah, yeah, okay. This was just to put a little timestamp on it. You'll notice there are some giveaway. There are some tells here as to when this took place, notably it being the end of Brian Kerr's reign. I think it was shortly after that. So we're probably talking late 2005 here when young Owen gets his claws, or at least tries to get his claws into Big Jack. Yes!
And I suppose now, after 10 years, I'm as much Irish as I am English.
Ireland are through to the quarterfinals of the World Cup.
Jack, if I can start by asking you, when you took over the Republic of Ireland job, did you set out any particular aims for yourself and for the team?
Of course. I mean, when I first took the job, I knew that we couldn't play in European competition or in World Cups or in qualification games of any description and play the same way as they were playing in Europe. We had to change our game and the approach we had to the game, which I did. I mean, I think one of the things that people have talked to me about from abroad when I've met people that played us or was played against us, and they've all said, you know, we didn't like the way you played because our players aren't used to you playing that way. Mm. Most of the teams in Europe, because I went out to Mexico for the World Cup and I watched the teams that we would be playing in the next qualification game for the European Championships, Belgium, and I went to see them twice. I learned a very great deal from the game I saw there, and one of them was to make Liam Brady close the people down in front of them quickly, not let the fullbacks have a look to see where they were going to play the ball, because they had a big guy who played up front. What was his name? Coolemans. Big lad, Coolemans. Very good head of the ball, very big, strong man. And he, if you let the fullbacks deliver the ball into the 18-yard box, he would always be on the end of it. Mm. And he would change the direction of the ball, which would cause you many problems. And I said to the players, the nearest person to their fullbacks, when they knock the ball to the fullbacks, because they deliberately played the ball from there, because fullbacks can drop off as far as they want to give themselves room and time to look and hit a long ball into the box. And I said, what you've got to do is you've got to stop the ball being served. So what you've got to do, the moment the ball gets played to the fullback, one of you, the nearest person, runs straight at them. Don't stop, just run straight out and make them go in a different direction so that they maybe have to play the ball inside or have to beat you.
Was there any way of doing that without necessarily sacrificing the creative talents, which was one of the criticisms that was levelled at you of the likes of Liam Brady, for example, Ronnie Whelan?
No, Liam, I'll come to that, but it was part of the job that Liam didn't want to do. He played for us in midfield, and I wanted Liam not to come and take the ball off the back four. I wanted Liam to take the ball off the front four, or the front two. And because I'd played against Arsenal with Sheffield Wednesday when I was manager there 5 times in an FA Cup. We played him 5 times in the semi-final of an FA Cup, and we got beat through Liam. And it was always because Liam, when he was up front, is one of the best passers of the ball you ever saw. He slides balls into people. He'll finish things off. He'll have goalkeepers off the line. When you remember when he played against Brazil, do you remember we beat Brazil 1-0 here in a friendly match? Not many people beat Brazil, but we did. And it was mainly because of Liam, and he scored a fantastic goal. But it was just because he was up front, off the back four, off the front two. And I wanted him to play that way. We could play whoever you wanted across midfield, but Liam had to have the freedom to perform the way he was capable of performing. That was my opinion. And I remember in a game, a ball got played to a fullback and he ran about 20 yards because he was the nearest person to him, and he ran about 20 yards and he blocked the ball as the guy went to hit it. And I stood up and I shouted at him, "That's what I want. Yeah. That's what I want you all to do. You must not let the fullbacks have the ball and serve it." And they didn't.
There was a very muted minority of the media that might have been somewhat critical of that style. I'm thinking Eamon Dunphy in particular.
Oh, Eamon Dunphy would be critical of anybody's style if you didn't agree with him. I mean, what did he ever produce? I don't like people like him. You know, if you said black, he'd say white. If you said white, he'd say black. You can't argue with people like that. And anyway, he's a non-event as far as I'm concerned. You might like him over here, but I don't like him in England, and he doesn't appear very much in England.
He's back in the media today, back in the news today, or this last week or two, along with John Giles and Brady himself. Brian Kerr had a pop at those three in particular for what he seemed to see were destructive comments in the media. Did you ever find that with high-profile people like that and big football men? Maybe you don't have respect for Eamon Dunphy, but the likes of John Giles and Liam Brady, who would command respect, do you think they... did you ever find people like that are deliberately destructive?
Liam got used to what I wanted him to do. And then, I mean, we qualified here. We'd qualified and we beat Romania 2-0, I think it was, here. And Liam got sent off the field, which meant that we qualified to play in, I think it was Germany. And Liam was sent off for a tackle on a guy, and it, which meant that he missed the first three games of the competition. Strangely enough, he went and did his ankle, and he did his knee, and he didn't go with us anyway. But he wouldn't have gone and played and have opened the three games, which was just a moment of madness for him, because but Liam was my. I always loved Liam Brady as a player. He's a tremendous player, but I wanted him to do it in the right areas, the ones that I wanted. And we had our differences, but he finally came around to it.
Was Germany, maybe because it was the first one, was that the sweetest one out of the most enjoyable tournament for you as a manager?
Well, it showed that we could compete at that level. That was the thing that came out of it. You know, we weren't afraid of anybody, and we could compete at that level, and we could beat people at that level. And then when we qualified to play in Italy, it was, we weren't afraid of anybody. We had good players, we had a good team, we had a good method of playing. We upset people in the way we played because they didn't want us to, what you call, apply pressure. Because when I get accused of being a long ball man, I'm not a long ball man. I only wanted the ball played, like if Niall Quinn went away to the left-hand side, if he didn't join in the build-up, he would take people away, because you can't have a fella with a header like Tony Cascarino or Niall Quinn, you can't have people like that in positions marked by only one little fullback. Yeah. You must have somebody else there as well. So they would give you, that'd give you a little bit more time and a little bit more room to build it down the side you wanted. We always played the ball in behind the fullback so that John Aldridge could get to the ball first, three out, and we'd always go down the line and have the ball played to him. If Ray couldn't cross the ball in, then he would knock the ball back to whoever was playing at fullback, and then they would deliver the balls in.
How difficult was it for you, as 1990, for example, the World Cup was unfolding, to shield the players from what was going on around? Were the hotels besieged by fans and all that sort of thing? Was it difficult to keep the players focused on what was going on the pitch?
No. The fans were always very good. They'd come in, the bar would be full, but the players weren't allowed in the bar. I mean, they could only go in the bar if they had relatives in or somebody like that, and had to go and talk to them in the lounge. But they had to get permission before they went out, and they weren't allowed out the hotel. I mean, everybody thinks that we were lapsedaisical and like we wouldn't let them out the hotel. Then if we did let them out, they would know exactly when they had to be back, and they knew they knew the rules very, very well, and they stuck with them.
There's been suggestions recently that the bond that was formed between the Irish national team back then in the late 80s and early 90s is different to what it is now. There have been some pieces that have come out recently and says that with all the Celtic Tiger and everything that's happened in Ireland, that we've actually changed as a people and we're more selfish maybe and a bit more mean and a bit more greedy. And we don't necessarily... The suggestion is that we'll never have the same joy that we did in those years, no matter what happens.
Well, obviously not, because, I mean, it's one of those things that you had never done before, and suddenly you achieve it and you're a part of it. It's new. It's something different. You know, we've never done it before, and then suddenly you've done it, two World Cups and a European Championship, and we got to a playoff against Holland for the last one. These were... They were sort of... People were getting to accept that that's what we would do. The longer I was in the job, the more difficult it was, for a simple way that we had to change the game a little bit in some of the years, because we had different players coming in. But not only that, the people abroad knew how you played now. I mean, if somebody was coming to play us, they might send somebody, oh, we'll go back and say, oh, they kick the ball in behind the fullback, and maybe it's okay, that's, we can handle that. And then suddenly you find that they're not really handling it at all.
I want to ask you a bit about Roy Keane, Jack, because Roy in his autobiography, talks about the time during the 94 World Cup where there was the training ground bust up and he was brought out, you brought him out along with Maurice Setters to explain that there had been no problem in the camp. He wasn't particularly happy with having to do that, or he says now that he wasn't particularly happy with having to do that. How did you find Roy to deal with during that World Cup and in the subsequent?
That was the only time I've ever had any need for I was away doing something. I wasn't at the training ground, and I'd left Morris in charge. But I'd said to Roy Keane, don't train, just go and do a few exercises with Mick, because he had a bit of a knock on something. I said, have a bath and, you know, settle down, don't worry. And then the next thing I knew, next thing Morris knew was he was playing in the game. We had a seven-a-side, and he was playing. And Roy said, no. And Morris said, no, you're not, you've got a knock. You're playing in a game. Come off. Leave it. And he brought him off the park. Roy wasn't happy because he was quite happy. He wanted to play. But looking at it from a managerial point of view and Morris's point of view, I'd already said that what he was to do, and he didn't do it. He wanted to play. We brought him off. And then there was a lot of press in Ireland, which we got back to America. A lot of the details, people were phoning up to say what was in the papers to the players, and the players were coming to me and saying, apparently with this Morris bringing this Roy Keane over, that everything's up the wall and that. I said, no, it's not, it's not at all. You know, I said, Roy knew he was doing what he shouldn't have been doing, because I had said him not to do it, and he was doing it. And Morris interpreted what I had said to him and got him off and made him go and relax. So when I went to, I went and got Roy, and we had a press conference the following day, and I went and got Roy and I took him into the press conference, and I said, now, from what I gather from Ireland, we've had a lot of feedback here that you are on about Morris Setters and Roy having an argument and nearly a fight. And I said to Morris, what do you say? Morris said, well, no, I only did what you were brought him off, boss. And I said to Roy, well, did you ever go at Morris? He went, no, he made me come off the field and I wasn't very happy, but I came off. And it was okay, there was nothing wrong. And they were trying to dig holes in a situation. They were trying to make insinuations that were just not there, because I had instructed that Roy should stay off the field. Morris did exactly what I told him he should do.
There was another Keane, Robbie Keane. There was criticism of Robbie and a few of the other players recently for going out 5 nights before the France game when they went out on the town. Now, I want to get your thoughts on this, because times certainly seem to have changed over the last 10 or 15 years as regards player preparation and the rest of that. Back in your time, there was that famous Harry Ramsden's challenge, which has been talked about many times, and it seemed as though there was no major problem with players, what players did a couple of days before a game. Maybe these days people are talking about 5 days before a game, there's no way that a player should be going out. But I assume that wasn't really thought about back then.
No, I don't. I couldn't understand what they were talking about, because we were coming back from, we'd been to Limerick to play, to train and to spend a bit of time over, and we trained and did our work over there. And then we got on the bus the day before the game and we came back into Dublin. And when we were coming in, I said to the lads, do you want some fish and chips? Because I was at Harry Ramsden's the other night and it was brilliant. And it was more of food than anything else. And I said, and they all went, we'll do, you know. So we stopped for fish and chips. What's wrong? Stopping for fish and chips the day before a game.
Well, there was a suggestion that there was sort of an all-you-can-eat sort of a thing going on.
Not at all. You get a plate full of fish and chips and you eat the fish and chips if you want them. Nobody had any soup to start with, nobody had any puddings to finish with. They had fish and chips. And I like fish and chips. And the players liked the fish and chips. And probably one or two of them, I think it was because the following day we lost the game. No, you can't blame fish and chips for losing the game.
No.
Can you?
Do you think that the journalists and people and maybe the public in general do get on players' backs a bit too much for what they do before games? For example, that story about a few of the players this time going out for a few drinks 5 days before a game. Would you see any problem with that, for example?
Not at all. We used to go out. I was brought up at Leeds United, where the rules were laid down. You, like, the boss, Don Revere, used to call me and Billy in. And he'd call us into his office on a Thursday, on a Friday morning. And he'd say, I've got a phone call today. You two were out in the pub last night. And I said, yeah, we were. And Billy said, yeah, we were. And he said, but we weren't drinking. He said, we only go in on a Thursday night because it's a domino night and we play dominoes. And I said, and we might have a pint of shandy or something like that. I said, but we don't drink. Mm. We don't drink. We just go in for the dominoes. It's domino night. And me and Billy only lived about a quarter of a mile away from each other. And but people would phone in and say that Billy and Jack Charlton were in this pub and they were drunk as newts, you know. And they always emphasise things which are not true. And I said to Don, well, we rather than sitting in drinking orange juice and that, we just like to go out on a Thursday night because it's a dead night, really, when you're a player, because you may be leaving on a Friday to go and play at Arsenal or Highbury, but you don't leave till a Friday. And you might not be playing until the Saturday. And you might have played on a Wednesday night to start with. And Don used to say to us, yeah, okay. And he let us do it. Mm. Now, when we used to go to the pictures here, I've told this loads of times, you know, the lads. We always went to the pictures on a Monday. And we go to the picture that some of the lads would go to that picture house and some would go to that picture house. And then we would meet on the bus and all come back. Now, I used to send Morris or one of the staff went with that group if they went to a picture house, and we went with this group. But we always, on the way back, the lads would start to sing, we love you, Jackie, we do. Which meant, can we stop for a pint? Now, I'm from a very famous footballing family called the Milburns. Jack, George, Jimmy and Stan Milburn all played professional football. Jackie Milburn, everybody knows, played for Newcastle. And George used to say to me, and Jack, never drink bottled beer. Only have draft beer, he says. And it's the best thing in the world for you because it's full of protein.
Right.
Now, when you're a player, you can drink as much orange juice and as much lemonade and as much crap as you want, and you can get away, and it's acceptable. But to have a pint of Guinness... Now, I used to say to Don, when we went to London, I said to Don, I said to the boss, when we have dinner on a Friday night, I said, can I not have a beer? I said, because I hate drinking orange juice and lemonade and that. I said, can I have a beer? And he said, yeah, if you want a beer, have a beer. That was the night before a game.
Yeah.
Now, everybody that looks into you and sees you doing things don't really understand. I mean, the lads wanted to... It was good for the lads. We used to go stop at Hill 16. And we go into Hill 16. You could have one drink. That was it. No more. You get one drink and then you're back to the hotel and you're off to bed.
Jack, just lastly, I want to ask you about Brian Kerr and... his recent, well, the fact that he wasn't given a new contract. Do you think he was given enough time in the job?
Sometimes you're lucky as a manager, sometimes you're unlucky as a manager. And I felt that in two games that looked like we were going to win, that was 2-0 against Israel at Lansdowne Road, and then winning 1-0 with a minute or two to go in Israel. And unfortunately, they got a goal and equalised on two occasions. And we dropped 4 points there. Had we taken just 1 point out of each, 3 points out of each of the two games, we would have qualified. But it didn't happen. And then when you lose players like Roy Keane and Damien Duff, and when you really, they are the people that will score you a goal if it's necessary, particularly
Damien Duff.
Damien Duff, who will take the ball at people, and he's a very, very difficult player. Now, you can't mark people with... You can't put extra people on him because you take things away from other positions.
Mm.
And now, it was just unfortunate that we lost him. And Roy Keane, obviously, missing the games because of an injury as well. Of the two players that you would have wanted to play in those two games, they were the two. They were definitely the two that you wanted to play in those games. And if they had played, he would have got results. And he would have still been in the job. And everybody would have been patting him on the back and saying how good you are. But his luck just run away from him. And he just lost things at the wrong time. The only thing I felt I disagreed with him with was when he started to change the players in Israel. Because I would never change a player unless he was injured. if the game was ours, if we were winning the game and everything was okay, leave it alone. Because if you change it, you change the structure, you change the players coming on, they've got to get warmed up, they've got to get part of the end of the game again. They don't have very long in 10 minutes or 20 minutes. So I would leave it alone. But that's the only thing I've got I could criticise him for. I mean, every, other than that, the lads have worked hard, they've performed well. They certainly can't condemn them, the players, for the lack of a bit, the lack of effort.
Okay, Jack Charlton, we're just about out of time, but it's been a pleasure talking to you, and thanks for taking your time out today to talk to us.
I don't know if I should comment on my own interview, Ken. What did you think of that?
I thought that interview was brilliant. I love that as well.
It's so good. Domino night.
I love everything about it.
Domino's night. Coolimans.
Domino's night.
You and Billy Bremer
don't
were
drink
drunk
bottled
as
beer.
It's amazing.
Oh my God. People, Jack Charlton still being angry about all the liars snitching on him to Don Revy 40 years later. He's still angry that people are lying that he's in a pub drinking.
Drunk as newts. Billy Bremner.
Drunk as newts. I love how easily he deals with all of my supposedly challenging questions. I'm just going ramshackle or scattergun from one topic to the next. And he's just, yeah, whatever.
Yeah, but there's a certain abrasive tone to some of your inquiries, but I quite like the way he just meets them head on. You know, he doesn't start going, who does this guy think he is? He just says, well, look, you know, the thing about Liam was, it was a part of the job Liam didn't want to do. Well, you know, Liam was lucky he was able to play so close to goal, got that winning goal against Brazil. It's a memory to share. So he can thank Jack for that one.
Ah, indeed. Nice to hear the voice of Jack Charlton. And that's it for today. And we'll have more podcasts later in the week, obviously, for World Service members. Thank you, Murph.
Thanks, Owen. Thanks, Ken.
Thanks, Ken. Kieran. Thank you, Owen.
And thank you, Jack Charlton. As Gavin Cooney of the 42 put it, Jack Charlton's main legacy is his making an extraordinary number of people extraordinarily happy. And I can't think of a better life lived than that.
That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
The second captain's
World Service.
It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's to persuade there's a world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.